So welcome, Eitan. We're glad to have you here. Eitan Hirsch is, would you be willing to be recorded? I should ask you that.
Sure thing.
Okay. Eitan Hirsch is Associate Professor of Political Science at Tufts University. His research focuses on U.S. elections, voting rights, and civic participation. Hirsch is the author of Politics is for Power in 2020 and Hacking the Electorate in 2015, as well as many scholarly articles. Hirsch earned his PhD from Harvard in 2011 and served as assistant professor of political science at Yale University from 2011 to 2017. His public writings have appeared in venues such as the New York Times, USA Today, The Atlantic, Politico, and the Boston Globe. Hirsch regularly testifies in voting rights court cases and has testified to the U.S. Senate Committee on the Judiciary about the role of data and analytics in political campaigns. So we welcome you, Eitan, to our Women Explore Forum.
Thanks for having me. I just ran out of lecture just now. It's raining. It wasn't raining when I got in there, but I'm back in my office and happy to be with you all here. So should I give a little talk and we'll have some questions and answer time?
Yeah, the way we sort of organize is you'll be with us from 12 to 1 and however you want to present things and invite questions. And then from 1 to 1:30, we have a kind of community-wide discussion.
Okay, good. So let me, I'm going to talk a bit about this book that I just wrote, and feel free, please, to ask questions or think about questions, and I'll leave plenty of time for us to have a broader discussion beyond me talking. Okay, so I guess I'll start by saying that the book that I wrote just now is not usually what I do. So here's the book, and it's written for a non-academic audience. Most of what I do is really boring statistical analysis. As Linda said, it's usually, you know, in court cases and things like that. I've been involved in some COVID-related voting rights issues in the past few months. But this book is something quite different, and I wanted to ask a fairly broad question, which is like, what on earth are all of us doing when we're doing politics? That's the question, right? If we add up all the time that many Americans spend today on politics, and a lot, like 30% of the country is spending an hour or two every day, every single day, at least cognitively engaged in politics. What does all of that amount to? And looking at the research on this topic, on this big, broad question, I came up with a fairly troubling answer. And the troubling answer is that almost all of us, something like 85 or 90% of us who think we're engaging in politics are not. So if you're in my class and I were to give a definition of engaging in politics, I would say something like engaging in politics is working with other people with some goal and some strategy for achieving that goal to influence the government. Pretty simple. Like, you might have a goal of getting new people in office, and your strategy is talking to neighbors to get them to vote for those new people. You might have a goal of a policy change on a particular area of public policy, and your strategy is lobbying bureaucrats or lobbying politicians. Regardless, you have some goal that's about the government, and you have a strategy for achieving it, and you work with other people to do that. Now, what I just describes the political activity of a very small fraction of Americans. And not just a small fraction of Americans in general, a small fraction of Americans who are spending 2 hours a day on politics. So what are the rest of us doing? The main thing most of us are doing is a form of news consumption that's increasingly really a form of amateur punditry. Right? We're reading the news, but we're also sharing the news. We're commenting on the news. We're commenting on other people's comments about the news. It's mostly news consumption. And if you ask Americans, why do you do that? Why do you spend so much time on the news? They generally answer you, well, it's my civic duty to be informed. why would it be a civic duty to be informed? You know, to know who to vote for, to know what action to take. But if you look at the actual ways that people are spending time in news consumption, that answer doesn't make any sense. That is, most of us who are paying attention to news obsessively, we're paying attention to stuff that is never going to inform our vote and not going to inform our action. We're paying attention to national drama and gossip, and we're not actually informing our actions, to the point where if you ask, maybe some of you have a news junkie in your life, or you are a news junkie yourself, but let's pretend that we have another news junkie we can blame for a second. So you have a news junkie in your life and you say, okay, news junkie, I want to get involved in, say, climate change. What should I do? And the news junkie blushes and says, oh, you misunderstand me. I can tell you about the a bug that was on Mike Pence's head for 2 hours. I can tell you about the Mueller report. I can tell you about the impeachment trial. I can tell you about the Comey Barrett hearings. I can't tell you a darn thing, though, about how you can get involved on climate change. And by the way, I can't even tell you who to vote for most state and local elections. I don't follow any of the news that could inform me of that. In fact, I, the news junkie, don't even vote in a local election because I don't know the first thing about local politics at all. In fact, if you look at American consumption of news, you have this very strange thing where the more educated you are, the more your attention is focused exclusively on national drama. That is, college-educated Americans today get their news from only national news sources, from New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Less educated Americans are getting their news from local TV news broadcasts, local newspapers. And so it's actually this college-educated segment of the population the most that is very attentive to all of the kinds of politics they don't need as citizens. Very kind of strange, unusual behavior. As an insider, maybe it's understandable, but if you're coming from like a Martian looking down at how people are spending their time on news, it would be hard to call that a civic duty to be informed. Okay, what about voting? Well, what is the data on voting? The data on voting is really clear. We have this very strange thing where we vote the most when it matters the least, right? So we all know this, that we're going to have a record high turnout here in Massachusetts on Tuesday. And it's sort of similar vibe to like maybe 2008, which some of you remember. It's kind of the last moment that was like this. That is a very unpopular Republican incumbent, a lot of energy on the Democratic side. You know, people are, were back in 2008, just like now, were giving their $5 donations. They were sharing viral videos. They were voting. They were getting on buses. I was in Cambridge in grad school at the time, and people were by the busload were going to New Hampshire to knock on doors, right? But even in Massachusetts, turnout was just exceptionally high in 2008, like it will be on Tuesday, when of course there's no chance that Massachusetts will be a close election on Tuesday, just like there was no chance in 2008. But if you look, just going back to 2008 for a second as a parallel example, what happened right after 2008? Massachusetts was incredibly important, had a very close Senate race and a special election, nationally important for Democrats because Ted Kennedy passed away and he was the 60th vote in the Senate. Massachusetts voters didn't only matter for their own state, but they mattered for the country. And what happens? All that energy, turnout goes way down, and it goes down the most in the most Democratic areas of the state. Right? Across the board during the Obama years, when Obama wasn't on the ballot, you see on the Democratic side just really pathetically low participation rates. People who were super energized about Obama couldn't make it to a town hall meeting to defend healthcare, which was his champion issue. Turnout among young people was high when he was on the ballot and dismally low in the midterm election years. Right, and we see this across the board. We see very high participation rates in presidential elections, even in places like here that are never going to be close, and then in state elections, in local elections, really, really insanely low turnout. Right, so you have, say, Massachusetts Democrats right now. If you ask Massachusetts Democrats, what's the big issue they care about? You know, they'll say climate change. No, they'll say COVID, but besides that, they'll say climate change. But when those issues are on the ballot in their own state in Massachusetts, no one cares. I mean, Charlie Baker, who's vowed not to raise the gas tax by a penny, has 90% approval rating among Democrats in Massachusetts, among Democratic primary voters. That is, the folks in Massachusetts who are gung-ho about Ed Markey, right? Love, because of the Green New Deal, love Charlie Baker. It's kind of amazing. And they love Charlie Baker because when it comes down to paying taxes and actually making big transit policies that are going to affect the environment and all that, they really don't want to get involved. They, no, thank you. I just want it to be a national fight between Democrats and Republicans, where our side, the Democratic side, is good and smart, and the other side is bad and evil, stupid, right? So we have a very strange behavior in voting. What about activism? What about activism? By the way, there's an optimistic side of the story I'm telling. I'm laying down the pessimistic, depressing side first, okay? So what about voting? What about activism? The most common form of activism in American politics today is, anyone know? It's the most popular form of activism. It's online petition signing. That's the number one way people take action in politics today beyond voting. And what do they do? So during the Obama years, I studied every petition that was sent to the Obama White House. And a colleague and I, we went through with students, we categorized every single petition. And so if you add up all the petitions that were on big domestic policy issues, you know, healthcare, taxes, education, parental leave, libraries, all that stuff, that amounted to 5% of the petitions that went to the Obama White House. What were the other 95%, right? What were the petitions? And the answer is they were a combination of jokes and just very small potatoes issues. I mean, the jokes were like, you know, Obama administration, you should deport Piers Morgan. That was a very popular petition. The serious ones were just little, like, you know, the FDA shouldn't regulate premium cigars. That was a big one. Or the White House should recognize diaphragmatic hernia awareness day. That was a big one. All kind of small issues, no support for big domestic issues. So if you add up all of these behaviors, the partisan cheerleading and the fair weather voting and the activism and the news consumption, what does this amount to? And in the book, I call this behavior political hobbyism, which is a deliberately insulting term. And I say this as a recovering political hobbyist myself, okay? To the extent that people are being chastised in this book, I'm being chastised too, I'll say that, okay? So why is political hobbyism insulting? Because many of the people who are spending all of their political time in these ways have really strong values in their hearts that are just not shining through in their actual behaviors. To call politics a hobby means we're doing politics for our own intellectual interests, like, isn't it interesting how Nate Silver thinks the polls are going to be like this? Or for emotional reasons, like to feel a sense of catharsis, to get something off of our chest, but not to serve political goals, not to get power for the things we care about, right? So the book is called Politics is for Power. By the way, just as hobbyism is an uncomfortable term for a lot of people, power is a very uncomfortable term for a lot of people as well. Right? What does it mean that politics is about power? It means that we're trying to get other people to take some action that they wouldn't otherwise take. Right? That's a power relationship. I'm trying to get someone to do something that they wouldn't do unless I try to influence them. That's really what politics is about. But for most of us, it's more about a hobby, right? It's in the category of life, sociologically, that's closer to like sports fandom. I mean, if you look at an obsessive sports fan, you know, listening to talk radio and talking about, you know, Tom Brady's personal life and following the statistics and feeling both anger and frustration and sadness at the loss and emotional highs at the game, that's what politics looks like to the outside world when it's based on these kind of hobbyistic strategies, okay? And we're in a very strange moment in politics right now because we know, just to give you a sense of the scope of this problem, engagement, cognitive engagement in politics is at an all-time high. And it was in 2016 too. You know, a political scientist like myself, we've surveyed Americans from the 1940s on every election year. How interested are you in the election? And we don't have 2020 data yet, but so far 2016 was by far the highest it's ever been, nowhere close. More people said they're interested in the election than any time in modern American history. But if you look at the people who said they did any kind of volunteerism or activism for a campaign or party, we're below the historical average. If you look at the people who are most cognitively engaged in politics today, that is who like read the news every single day, most of them belong to zero organizations. Most of them in the last year say they've attended zero meetings about any kind of civic or political topic. Most of them say zero times in the last year have they worked with anyone else on any kind of civic or political venture. And these are the people who are most cognitively engaged in politics, right? If you look at the people who in 2016 said they were most afraid of Donald Trump, something like 4% of them reported any kind of volunteer engagement for a party or campaign, 4%. So what's going on here, right? What's going on here? The book that I wrote has really four goals. The first is just to try to describe what most of us are doing, what this hobbyism looks like, what is it all about? The second goal is to try to explain why so many of us do politics like this. That is, why do we do politics like a hobby? Has it increased over time? Do we do it more like this now than previous generations? And there are a number of answers that are somewhat complicated. We could talk about them, but the most obvious answer to why this has increased over time is not surprisingly tied to technology. And the technological explanation here is actually we have shifted all of our leisure time, or many of us have shifted all of our leisure time online to things we can do in 5-minute stints spread throughout the day. So I don't know if other of you have this, but on my iPhone here, I have that app that tells you how long you've been on the iPhone every day. And if you have this, you'll probably have this uncomfortable realization like I have, which is like, you know, at the end of the week, you say, oh, you average 2 hours a day on this thing or something. You're, holy moly, that's a lot of time. A lot of people are spending a huge amount of leisure time on whatever their subject matter is. It could be sports, it could be politics, but it's kind of toggling back and forth throughout the whole day. 5 minutes here between reading emails, between working, between doing the laundry. You know, from my perspective, anything to put off making my children's lunches for the next day, you know, I'll look at my Twitter feed. But it adds up, but we're never spending an hour, a chunk, like we are spending in community right now. It's very rare. Fewer people are dedicating an hour or 2 hours in the evening saying, okay, this is my leisure time I can dedicate to a civic or political purpose where I can have a strategy and a goal and hold other people accountable and hold myself accountable. All right, so technology is a big part of it. The third goal of the book, so the first is, what is this thing? Politics. It's a hobby for most of us. The second is, why do we do this more now than the past? The third goal of the book is to evaluate a question some of you might have running through your head right now, which is there any redemption in this? That is it possibly good? Or is it bad? In other words, a self-centered way to put this is to say, aren't I better? You know, I spent 2 hours watching a Senate hearing on Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Aren't I better than the person who didn't spend any time on it? Aren't I better than the person who doesn't read the news at all? Sure, I just obsess over Rachel Maddow. That's not that productive. But aren't I a better citizen than the person who doesn't do that at all? And maybe you think, like, it will lead to this. Like, you know, that hobbyism is a gateway into real political action. I'm going to argue in this book, or I do argue in this book, that that is not true, that it is not a gateway into real political action. And not only that, that it's harmful to the political process. Okay, so why is it ineffective as a gateway into real political action? Basically because we are learning the wrong information and practicing the wrong skills. So the information is sort of obvious. Like if you're spending a lot of time thinking about the Supreme Court, you're really not spending time learning about how you can take a civic action. You know, I remember a funny thing. There was like a controversy during these primaries about the Iowa caucus and how it was working. I was realizing more people in Massachusetts are learning about the intricacies of the Iowa Democratic Party than know a thing about the Massachusetts Democratic Party and how power flows through our own state. Right? So we're learning the wrong information. We are also, and this is more important, practicing the wrong skill set. So I said before that politics is about power relationships. And indeed, we have power relationships in pretty much all aspects of our lives. You know, teachers and students are in a power dynamic. Bosses and employees, parents and children, right? So like I have three little kids, so this is most salient in my mind, right? If I want to get my three-year-old daughter to take a bath, she doesn't want to, right? I'm in a sort of a power relationship with her. And just like with my students, they want something from me. They want good grades, and I want something for them to learn stuff. And politics is like that, right? I want something from other voters. I want something from politicians. And in all those relationships, there's actually a pretty good recipe to getting what you want, which is empathy, which is seeing my three-year-old daughter and saying, what does she want right now? How can I, in a non-physical, removing her to the bath, can I say, oh, you know, take two more minutes playing with those Legos, right? What does she want? What do my students want? Or from their perspective, how can they please me so that I will give them what they want, right? We think about this. How do we look someone in the eye and take them seriously to move them in our direction, right? Real politics is about that. But in political hobbyism, that is not the goal. And so that is not the skill set that we practice. Online, when we're having a discussion or a fight on Facebook or Twitter, the goal is never to move someone in our direction. It's catharsis. It's getting something off of our chest. It's making us feel better. And so the reason that that is terrible for us is that we're not practicing the right skill set at all for doing real politics, which is moving people towards us. But political hobbyism is worse than just that. It's actually bad for the political process itself. And the way that you can see this most clearly is in low dollar political donations. Okay? Low dollar political donations. I usually, when I speak before groups, ask them, who is the best politician at raising low dollar donations? And almost every time I ask, people say, oh, Bernie Sanders. But that's not the right answer. The right answer is Donald Trump. In 2016, Donald Trump raised more in low dollar donations than Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton combined. And the reason that President Trump is so good at raising low dollar donations is because he's very good at the recipe for low dollar donations, which is provocation, outrage, yelling at someone. This is actually something that both sides learn very quickly. During the original Obama campaign, which was really did more low dollar donations than anyone before him, the campaign learned very quickly that the messages that got the most donations the quickest were ones that make fun of Sarah Palin. That was the number one way to get low dollar donations. And after the campaign in 2008, the Obama campaign kind of said, we feel uncomfortable about this. After the 2008 election, Obama's elected, some of you remember that he gave a speech before Congress about healthcare. And Congressman Wilson, Joe Wilson, shouted at him in the middle of the House chamber, you lie! And within 24 hours, raised $2 million, all low-dollar donations. We see that on both political sides, this is the way to get low-dollar donations, is by making viral videos. So what does this tell politicians? This tells them that when they're on a debate stage or whether they're in a congressional hearing, their thing they're trying to do, I mean, watch any congressional hearing, the thing they're trying to do is make a viral video of themselves so that we, the hobbyists on our couch, can feel good about ourselves, feel a sense of cathartic release when we give $5 to the politician. So we're incentivizing quite bad behavior among politicians. Right? They're not acting that way because they want to. They're acting that way because we, when we're giving donations to anyone who makes a viral video, we're incentivizing it. Okay, so far I've told you a fairly depressing story with the first three goals of this book. But I will tell you that if you get a chance to read the book, and I hope you will, the book doesn't have a negative vibe. It has a quite positive vibe, because the fourth goal of the book, which is the most important goal of the book, is about the alternative to political hobbyism, which is doing real politics. And I talk about that through telling the story of 7 organizers, 5 women and 2 men, ranging in age from 19 to 98, who do politics just completely differently than most of the rest of us. And I think have a lot of insight to how we can do politics in a much better, much more positive, much more effective way. So let me just tell you one of those stories, or maybe 2 of those stories, to give you a sense of what I'm talking about, okay? And maybe I'll tell you the story of the oldest person in the book, the 98-year-old, who is one of my favorite people in this book. And the 98-year-old is someone here from here in Massachusetts who is named Nach Visoki. Has anyone heard of this person before? You probably haven't. But I'll tell you that in a certain domain of politics, he's quite famous. Because what I learned before I met Nach Visoki is that he was called the Ukrainian boss, that he controlled 1,000 votes, that he had been under investigation by the Department of Justice, and that all the local politicians loved him. I figured I want to learn about this person. I want to meet him. And here's the story that I learned. Nach Visoki, Nach, he came to Massachusetts around 1980 from the Ukraine. He had been a Holocaust survivor, a prisoner of war in Siberia, and lived most of his life in Ukraine, and then came to the United States as a retiree. At the end of his very end of his career. And he moved to a low-income senior living facility in Brighton. And that same facility is where I encountered him decades after he moved there. And Nach is not someone who did any politics whatsoever his whole life. But when he moved here in retirement, he started to be a do-gooder, basically drive other people to the doctor's office, put on community events in the retirement home. He just kind of wanted to make himself useful to other people and be a good person. And that was the extent of his social activism until the 1990s. Some of you will remember that in the 1990s, the Congress and President Clinton passed a welfare reform law. And the original law was going to be quite harmful to people like Nach. That is, even if you were here completely within the bounds of the law, completely legally, but you were an immigrant legally, and even if you lived in a nursing home, and even if you didn't speak English, you would be denied any kind of benefits like food stamps unless you worked. And this was a major point of controversy. The Catholic Charities said there was going to be a suicide epidemic among low-income seniors. And it was a pretty serious situation. And Nach did a few things. The first thing he did was he started going to the press, even though he has very broken English. And he even went down to Washington, D.C. And he gave a speech before the National Press Club. And I'll just read you the last paragraph of that speech. He said, "I ask the Congress on behalf of all refugees, old and sick people, to be more sensitive to the terrible situation they are in and to take care of them. I pray for a change in the new law to give old people comfort, people who have lived with hardships, beatings, and threats in their native country. They cannot work. Many cannot really learn English. I ask our government to help them to live their lives in peace in our democracy." Now, in addition to speeches like that, Nach and his wife Clara did this amazing thing, which is they helped 300 of their neighbors get citizenship. So many of the folks who had come from the former USSR by this point in the mid-90s were eligible for citizenship. But they were elderly and they didn't speak great English and they didn't take the citizenship test. And Nach and Clara start making these well-organized group meetings where they practice the 150 questions that might be on the citizenship test, and they practice having interviews, and they drive everyone to the test location. And over a period of a year or so, they got 300 of their neighbors to pass the citizenship test. Now, in that time, the law was actually changed. So it didn't affect the folks, but they got the citizenship. Okay, then what happens is Nach converts his activism to politics because he realized that the way to take care of his neighbors is not just through putting on social events, but that politics is an important way we also take care of our neighbors. And he and his friends, he called them his lieutenants, but it's just a bunch of old Russian immigrants living in Brighton. They started making a slate of candidates from national to local offices, passing out like sample ballots, who everyone should vote for, making sure everyone got out the vote on election day. And within a few election cycles, you know, by say the early 2000, 2001, you start seeing that their precinct in Brighton has three times the turnout rate of all the precincts around it. And everyone's voting the same way. And this raises alarm to the U.S. attorney. What's going on here? I mean, when I first told you this story that there's a Ukrainian boss who controls 1,000 votes, your first reaction might be, that's a little sketchy. What's going on? And that was what the Justice Department said too. And they looked into it. And what did they discover? That there's nothing shady going on at all. That what's going on is someone who's built rapport with their neighbors, built trust, who is a hero in this community. And people vote the way he suggests because he follows local politics. He understands what's going on and he has their back. Now, when their turnout is so high, politicians come. They do him favors, you know, they drive him to the supermarket. But they do more important things. When they have a complaint, like there's a major mobility issues in this community in Brighton, they couldn't get there to go from their building to the T. The owner, absentee landlords weren't shoveling their snow. They have problems like that. And state legislators are out there shoveling their walk, right? Not only solving the problem by getting the government to do it, but literally the state legislator from his district and his staff are shoveling the walk. But when they have bigger questions about asylum, about immigrant rights, they also have the ear of politicians too. And Nach does this, you know, and I'm meeting with him and I'm spending time in his tiny little apartment in this building. And this book that I wrote came out in January 14th. And right before I was going to deliver him a copy, an early copy of the book, I learned that Nach passed away 3 days shy of his 99th birthday. This is about New Year's Eve. And, you know, I had built a relationship with him and I wanted to attend his funeral in part because, you know, as we all know, when a 99-year-old person dies, they don't necessarily have a huge community of folks with them. And so I went to his funeral in Brookline, where I live. And, you know, there were about maybe 40 or so people from the Russian community there. And then sitting in the front row at this funeral home is Charlie Baker and Marty Walsh and state legislators and city councilors. And, you know, there were no votes to be gotten here. This wasn't a political, there's no selfies to take. These politicians were basically just paying tribute to someone who, like, knew how to do politics, right? And what that means is that he realized that politics is not about paying attention to important things. It's about being important. It's about serving your community and getting political power to get your values into government. And, you know, all the stories in the book from the 19-year-old, there's two college students. There's a woman in Brooklyn who spent every weekend over in Staten Island talking to Republicans. She's a Democrat. There's a woman, Angela, in the most Republican area of rural Pennsylvania, who built this incredible coalition and still has it today. It's a very important coalition in Pennsylvania politics today. And her story is very similar. And folks of all ages, of all political stripes, they know the secret here, which is that while the rest of us do politics like it's a hobby, they're trying to empower their values. And there are people we like and people we don't like who are doing that very well. At the beginning of the book, I give an example of the Ku Klux Klan. And in 2018, that's just 2 years ago, the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina went around and said to opioid addicts, "Do you have an opioid addiction? We here at the White Knights of the KKK are here to help you. and they had effectively an opioid clinic. And I tell that story early in the book because I want readers to say, holy moly, that's what the KKK is doing? They're not just going around with torches and screaming about white supremacy. They're going and looking people in the eye, and they're recruiting members by offering assistance and empathy. And if they're doing that, am I doing that? Are groups that I like doing that? Or are we just paying attention to Twitter? And the truth is that there are people on all sides of the political spectrum doing the KKK model, but there are more people, particularly on the political left, who shy away from that altogether. They find real politics to be parochial and beneath them, and what they really want to do is read the New York Times and pay attention to important stuff going on in Washington. And that's what this book's about. And it's about helping readers see the look in the mirror and say, gosh, am I a hobbyist? Do I feel good about that? Why do I do politics like this? And what's the alternative? So maybe I'll stop there. And I'd invite you to ask questions or comments or criticisms. I'm very used to being criticized. So you're welcome to share critiques or questions of any kind. Virginia Lofton. You're on mute, though. Can people unmute themselves?
Yes, you can. Okay. Thank you. Can you hear me now?
I can, yes.
Yes. Thank you for stirring my consciousness and not only defining according to your hypothesis and experience, but I had no idea that I have been actually very, very political without realizing it. I live in a senior complex and I'm constantly in touch with everybody here. There's like 100 people here, and constantly seeing how I can do something that will help them or assist them in improving their lives. And I had no idea that it was, quote unquote, political.
Thank you for that comment. I think that's right. I mean, I think that a lot of people actually want to put community service, say, in one bucket of their lives and put politics in another. That yeah. Politics is about Democrats and Republicans fighting, basically. And community service is something different. But I think that all of the best organizers I've seen going around the country, those things are one and the same.
Yeah. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for the comment. Yes, I see Lee. I see, Lee, go ahead.
Last Sunday at the National Cathedral, the preacher quoted William Blake, and it seems a pertinent quote to what you've just said. I sought my soul, but my soul I could not see. I sought my God, but it eluded me. I sought my neighbor and found all three.
Yeah, that's a beautiful quote. There's a, I'll just share one thought, which is that, in the book, there's an important parallel I make to religious participation. And I'll just try to summarize that briefly. On the political left today, particularly among college-educated liberals, there's this phenomenon that people identify as spiritual but not religious. And what does this mean to identify as spiritual but not religious? Very, very dominant kind of position among well-educated white liberals. And it basically is saying, I want to try to extract personal benefits from religion, like some spirituality for myself, and not obligate myself to other people in a community. I want to get a spirituality iPhone app that will make me feel better for a few minutes. But I don't want to go to a church where I have to serve other people, where people are going to ask things of me. This is basically what political hobbyism is. Political hobbyism says, can I extract some intellectual or emotional benefits from politics without obligating myself to other people in a community organization? Can the internet help me do that? Yes. But that's not politics. And I think that, without making a religious appeal here, I think folks who are regularly participating in religious community would find, you know, you can't have one without the other. Unless you're serving your neighbors, unless you're part of a community, you're not going to get a fraction of the spiritual or intellectual or emotional benefits from religion. I think that's basically the parallel. And, you know, this is also the reason why, you know, it's strange. I give a lot of talks about this. To this day, the political left seems to think that it's the party of the grassroots. But truly, it's not. I mean, the church networks, the pro-life networks on the right, the gun clubs and gun rights movement, the most clear examples we have today of bottom-up political engagement are on the political right. And they start with churches. I saw Marianne's comment, question.
Yeah, I had it. So the story that you told about the Ukrainian gentleman really struck me because it reminded me of stories of when immigrants came into the cities to begin with.
Karen?
Yes.
Could you please mute?
So they came, immigrants came into the cities, and one of their ways of, or one of the sources of help for them was the local political operation. And, you know, that came to have a bad rep. But in fact, what they did in the beginning anyway was just to solve little problems for people. Who to talk to, where to go, how to get something done. And, I'm still reminded of Tip O'Neill's All Politics is Local, which I think means keep your eye on what's going on in the community and help there.
That's exactly right. So that you know, when I said there's some historical parts of the book that are kind of too complicated to say in a sentence when I was introducing the talk, that's right. That's one of the big historical things that have changed, where local political parties don't really exist to do that in the same way. And local attitudes have changed. Again, there's a sense, as the Democratic Party became more dominated by college-educated people, there was a real rejection of what seemed like parochial politics. And some of that is because there was, of course, corruption and racism in local political parties that justified a movement away from that form of politics, but they threw a whole lot out along with that. And, you know, I would just say that I'll just give you a quick summary of one of the other stories in the book. It's another immigrant, just like Nach's an immigrant. The other immigrant in the book is this woman, Kiris Matias, who is also fairly local. She is up in Haverhill, Massachusetts. And Kiris is the leader of what she calls the Latino Coalition of Haverhill. Okay? And she's a Dominican immigrant. She doesn't speak much in English. I interviewed her through a translator. And her day job is she's a school bus monitor for a special needs school in Haverhill. Okay? But she brings the Latino community together in a very organized fashion to engage in politics. So just to give you an example, one of the schools, elementary schools in Haverhill, the majority of the families are Latino immigrants. And the majority of the families in the school. And there is not a single teacher or staff member in the school who can interact with the parents in Spanish. So they bring 30 people together with the school superintendent and they say, come on. And when 30 people are organized, that makes a big difference. Then they bring 30 or 40 people to the police superintendent and say, tell us exactly how you interact with ICE. How do you interact with federal immigration? And they bring to the mayor and they say, how come our town is 30% or whatever Latino and there's no Latinos in government jobs? Now, it would be a mistake to call those issues like local parochial issues. They are deeply tied with national issues. They're deeply tied with national priorities, racial equality, they're tied to the issues that Democrats, including college-educated white Democrats, say are their most important priorities, right? So it's not just fixing potholes. This is the local version of race, immigration. And yet, most people, including in Massachusetts, think of that level of politics as beneath them, right? There is something so unbelievable here in Massachusetts about this idea that we want our senators in the United States Senate, Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren, to be champions of the left. But we are very, very comfortable with the status quo in state politics. We don't really want to solve the housing crisis. We don't really want to work on environmental issues. We don't want to pay for a big new transit system. We don't want to deal with racial equality or inequality in schools, policing. There is no demand. And you can see that without taking a position. I mean, it's very clear that the governor has such strong support for taking a very middle of the road path, which is fine, but it's very inconsistent with what Democrats say they want out of government at a national basis, right? If I were going to write an ad for the Republican Party, it would be the fact that 90% of Democrats in Massachusetts like Charlie Baker. What I interpret that to mean is that when they say they want the Green New Deal, they're joking. The Green New Deal is a joke. The racial equality is a joke. And you know it's a joke because they like politicians who want really no change to the status quo on big issues like the environment, which I realize is when I say this to my students, many of whom volunteered for the Ed Markey campaign, I say, Ed Markey, where were you for Jay Gonzalez? Where are you? You know, the Massachusetts could do a hell of a lot on the environment with transit reform. But, you know, people's politics, particularly on the left, are very nationalized, right? This is another phenomenon that's changed over time. People are very attentive to national politics and are ignoring state and local politics. Yes, Nancy Atwood.
It seems to me that a lot of the contact that citizens have having to do with politics is through organizations that don't appear to be associated with politics per se. Like the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization, which is really has quite a bit of influence. And I got to know my state senator, my state representative, through working with that organization and lobbying, which I have no particular interest in politics per se, but that conduit is how I got involved. So that must be true of a lot of people.
Well, that's exactly everything you said up to say that everything you said up to that's true for a lot of people is absolutely right. So GVIO is a great example of a well-organized group which has a base of religious communities that can be together and take action together, engage in collective action. We're not here for the politics, but we care about immigrant rights, or we care about this or that.
Sure.
Right? Uh-huh. Or, you know, the New York version of this, you know, does, I think, a lot more than GVIO actually on things like renters' rights, you know, organizing low-income church communities and say, you know, we gotta stop these evictions that are being on whatever. But what you, I think, are not, the last thing you said, that this is a common way of engagement, is not right. That is, most people have no attachment to organizations like the one you just described, and have absolutely, you know, they've never been to the state house. They would never think of lobbying the state house. That's a very unusual but admirable position to be in.
I think what I meant is most people who get involved and have any contact at all with politicians are doing it because they belong to some lobbying organization.
That's right. Or just any civic organization that gets them.
Exactly, yes. You
know, look, my neighbors, about 100 of my neighbors every election get an email from me that says, here's who's on the ballot in Brookline. Here's who I'm voting for. Okay, now how do I know 100 people in my neighborhood? Well, for my synagogue community. And I'm not the leader of that. I'm just like the dude there who knows something about local politics. So they, you know, we have a relationship where they say, okay, I'll defer to you. You seem to know more about this than me, you know. But, you know, again, a lot of people, and this is, again, increasingly true among young people and people on the left, are not in social networks that are tied to local communities like that. Yes, Mary Rose.
Can you
First of all, can you spell the Ukrainian immigrant's name for us?
Sure.
Knock.
I just put it in the chat.
Oh, thank you. And also, just on a positive note, you must be impressed with people like Greta Thunberg and young people around the world, and including Black Lives Matter leaders and women's leaders. I'm thinking of the march after Trump was elected. What do you think about the positivity of all that?
So basically, you're not going to catch me saying negative things about people who are trying, okay? But right. What I would say is that there's a great risk. I'll say this. Social media has made it easier than ever to get a lot of people together to do something quickly. But that stuff often is not long-lasting.
Okay.
In the book, I use the example of the Arab Spring, revolution in Egypt, which could get hundreds of thousands of people to Tahrir Square, bring down the government. But what happened to the Arab Spring? I mean, the Arab Spring, which is the movement for lots of revolutions in Arab countries, was a tragedy. The net result of the Arab Spring was hundreds of thousands, millions of people displaced, refugees dying on boats. And if you look at what happened in Egypt, the reason that the Arab Spring was such a failure, right, to bring back everyone's memory, right, there was a collapse of the government because of these protests. Then there was an election. And the protest movement, which was generally well-educated, kind of middle-class people, they were not organized into real organizations. They did not have people like Nach. They were organized online and dispersed. They didn't have someone who was going to knock on 30 doors. And so what happened was there was an election, which was won by the Muslim Brotherhood. And after it was won by the Muslim Brotherhood, there was then a military coup, right? Because the Muslim Brotherhood does the kind of service provision that parties do. It has healthcare services, it has education services, has a reputation not just for having an extreme ideology, but by helping people. And the one-off movements, sometimes those lead to real concerted organizing, but sometimes they just evaporate. So, if you think about something like Black Lives Matter, I think it's a very good example. At the level of the organizers, it's a very thoughtful movement. It has very concrete goals. But the level of mass participation, it takes on a different look, right? So I usually say this to groups. I say, many people on this call participated in a Black Lives Matter protest or rally. A lot of Americans did over the summer. And almost surely at that rally, someone stood up in front and said, "Thank you for coming. This is step one. And what we really need you to do is when our issues come before the city council or the police, we need you to be there. We need you to come to a hearing. We need you to write public comments. We need you to back us up." And so as people ask me all the time, is Black Lives Matter hobbyism? And I say, well, if you went to one of those rallies and the rally was the beginning and the end of your engagement, then it kind of feels like maybe you did it more for you. Maybe it was just about you feeling good. But if you then went on and became someone who took an interest in the issue, then no, then it was a gateway into real activity. I have to say, I spend a lot of my time on this issue. There's an 11-person task force in Brookline, where I live, on policing, and I'm on it. It's majority non-white task force. And one of the most stunning things, we had our first kind of public hearing. We're like appointed by our select board, okay? And then we had a public hearing. And 100% of the public comments came from allies of the police department saying, "Everything is great. What are you people trying to do here?" 100%. If you look at people about housing, someone wants to build a big apartment building with affordable units. 100% of the public comments say, "Not near us, not in my neighborhood. I don't want you to Manhattanize our neighborhood. So I think that, you know, it's very easy to start a big idea, a women's march, a Black Lives Matter protest, and get a lot of people on board. But I think time and again, we're seeing those things are not actually translating into long-term engagement because people are really unaccustomed to thinking, I have a role to play here. And it's not just attending a march. It's spending time on this. And I'm not asking people to spend time that they wouldn't otherwise spend. I'm talking about people who are spending an hour or two every day on politics, but they're not using it to write a public comment or to be in an organization. They're using it to follow stupid stuff on Twitter. Yes, Barb.
It occurs to me that the skill set that it takes to get out there and interact with your community is a little different than the skill set that it takes to interact on your computer. And I'm a little concerned. I sort of track what the sociologists are talking about in terms of some of the up and coming generation that may spend 6 or more hours a day with digital devices. And I'm wondering, you know, what you do to help engender the level of skills so that people in fact are comfortable interacting with others. And I don't know, you know, what comfort is in terms of a confidence level, but also in terms of how they define themselves, I would guess.
Yeah. You're exactly right. And you, by the way, you see that in the demographics, right? So the person who spends the most time on their computer following politics like a hobby is a college educated white man. And the person who's spending the most time in real politics is overwhelmingly a woman, like not even close. I mean, if you go to any activist group in the country today, particularly on the left, you'll see a group that's roughly 2/3 or more women. And it's disproportionately non-white. So that is like African Americans spend less time following the news than white voters, but they spend a lot more of their time in active volunteer roles. You also see something that I don't actually have statistics on, but one of the things that I think is kind of curious is nearly every person in the book who I profile, who's like a very successful organizer, volunteer, they identify themselves as not into talking, you know, shy. They identify, they're not the kind of kid who sits in my front row of my elections class and raises their hand every second, right? It's a different kind of quiet power. It's the person who can guilt other people into coming to a meeting and holding them accountable. You know, it's not an overt person necessarily who's good at real politics. I would say the number one thing to do is that, folks at every age need to practice this, right? I often speak to groups that are like, you know, activist groups, and they're saying, how can we get young people involved? You know, that's like a big question. How can, you know, I talk to League of Women's Voters groups or Common Cause groups or whatever, and they have boards that are, you know, they have communities that are fairly aging. So how do we get the young people involved? And I would say the number one question I ask them is, how many high school students or college students do you have on your executive board? And the answer is usually zero. And if you want to know what high school and college students want and don't want, what they don't want is to be soldiers in someone else's army. But they, and that's been true for all time. It's not new to this generation. But I think that they feel that there are not a lot of on-ramps for leadership. And I think the most successful intergenerational groups that I've seen are ones that put young people forward in leadership positions of organizations, help them be leaders, but give them responsibility and power in an organization. And I think when you see that, you see people practicing, and it has this kind of amazing moderating force. You know, I think when you, I'll use this local example, bike lanes. You know, there's a big movement to put bike lanes everywhere. Okay, for environmental reasons, for health reasons, whatever. And who are the opponents of bike lanes, right? So you may imagine you get young people on board, say, all right, let's go. You care about the environment. Let's work on a project. Let's get bike lanes. And And, you know, at first you might think, oh, well, the other side, what bunch of jerks doesn't want bike lanes, right? And then you'll learn something like, it's small business owners who don't want to give up the parking spots in front of their businesses. And when you realize that the other side on an issue like that are not like evil, stupid bigots, but they're just people who are like small business owners who are worried about giving up their bike lane, then you say, okay, well, now we need to answer a question. Like, is it going to hurt your business or not? But it's not good versus evil, right? And anytime we work on real politics locally, it's a moderating because you see that there's no blue bubble here, right? I mean, if you're in Brookline, Cambridge, or where I am in Brookline, these are 90% Democratic plus towns. There's no blue bubble when it comes to racial politics or environmental politics. Absolutely not. There is no, and when I give talks in Utah at like Brigham Young University, 90% of people might be Republican, but they have the same issues on housing and race and all that stuff. So I would say the most important thing to do is to take local action where you don't have a luxury of treating the other side as a bunch of evildoers. They're, you know, it's just your neighbors who don't want to pay higher taxes, or, you know, your neighbors who don't want this or that. I think we have time for one more question.
Let me ask the question then. So the title of our talk was, Is Our Electoral Integrity at Risk? And I keep feeling in the back of my mind somehow that what you're talking about does affect electoral integrity. But I can't put it into words. I don't know if you have words for it. It's like, I guess, the basic integrity of what we're voting for, how we're voting, how that matches what we want, how it gets us to where we want to go. Can you say something about that before you leave?
Sure. So, right. I mean, look, right. It's a very interesting question because, you know, like I said at the beginning of the talk, I mean, I work on issues that are very different from this. It's like, are ballots counted, right? Like, I go before courts and say, how do we count ballots? And that feels like closer to the text question of election integrity. But actually, this stuff is very close to it because, for one thing, like, the temperature is very high in politics, in part because we're not treating it right. We are treating it more like a sport. We don't have a great view about, like, what's important and what's not important. I mean, not only are we willing to spend a whole day of a news cycle talking about, like, a bug on Mike Pence's head, which is just ridiculous, right? You know, it was just an embarrassing thing to talk about.
Right.
But we don't have a good sense of proportion. You know, I sometimes have this question I put to Democrats. I say, you know, what are the Republican conspiracy theories and what are the Democratic conspiracy theories? And they can go on for hours about Republican conspiracy theories. They say, okay, what are the Democratic ones? They say none. I said, do you think Trump is a Russian agent? They say, well, maybe. Here's why Trump might be a Russian agent. You know, then they launch into their whole thing. Well, maybe not Donald Trump, but Melania is an agent. You know, like you know, anyone who's watching, like, MSNBC is going to believe a whole set of crazy things. And I think we don't have a sense of proportionality of what's really important and what's not important. And in part, that's because, again, you take something like, On the Democratic side, you take the issues of race and the environment, which are the two issues after COVID at this point, which are the number one priorities of Democrats. And they, when you ask Democrats, particularly like people who are active in politics, they put life and death language around these issues. They say, this is existential. This is the most important stuff going on in the world. But they conveniently only want to talk about it in terms of our Massachusetts senators fighting with senators from Mississippi. They don't really act like it. And so we get this weird view of the world where we say these really heated things. I hate Republicans. They're evil. I'm afraid of them. But we don't really act. We don't believe that, number one, when it comes down to it. And number two, like, we don't actually act in a way that we're threatened by this unless we actually are, right? I mean, there's a reason why you see African-Americans more active in volunteer engagement than white voters. And there's a reason why you see, particularly after 2016, women much more engaged than men. It's because a lot of people do feel threatened and do take action accordingly. But it's still the case that you know, something like 90% of us don't.
So the lack of integrity is how our values match or don't match our actions.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
Thank you.
All right, folks. I got to go.
So thank you very much. We appreciate your time and your talk. And we will continue our discussion after you leave.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye, Eitan. So this is our time to discuss. And do you guys want to do it in breakout groups or do you want to do it as a whole group?
As a whole.
Okay. So what we have about 20 minutes to discuss what we've just heard and how we're thinking it through and how it's hitting us and what we're learning. And I would ask people to be mindful of the time that they take so that as many people as possible can have a chance. And usually we try to give a chance to someone who hasn't spoken yet as well. So who would like to start either with a comment or a confrontation or a disagreement or a whatever? Elizabeth, you're muted.
This is a question. I came late, so I didn't hear his introduction, but it seems as if he wouldn't be that bothered or concerned or worried or fearful the way I am if Donald Trump wins, because the reality at the more local level is good for, you know, politics and people's voices and values getting getting heard, getting implemented, etc. So the implication for me is it's not such a big deal if Trump were to get elected. I mean, that's been my absolute paranoia, biggest fear, et cetera. That's the implication of his talk to my ears. And I wondered if he addressed that in the very beginning or no?
Not directly, no. But, you know, it does remind me of the comments that have been made about Amy Coney Barrett being approved for the Senate, I mean, for the Supreme Court, which is the way to fight back is to get laws and to get laws passed. So they, you know, in the event of something that might be not feeling right for you, you can try then to get laws passed on the legislative end that secure certain positions for women, for instance. So his message was somewhat like that, is get down into the grassroots and get legislation and get support from the grassroots up. And he was really challenging us, Elizabeth, to decide if we are political hobbyists or political activists. And that he's really challenging us to examine that in ourselves. Yes, Barbara?
Yes. Hi. I'm sorry I missed the first part. I was these Zoom meetings are driving me crazy, but I didn't really get that impression from what, as you did, Elizabeth. What I was struck by is that he gave a perspective to think about that's way beyond white New England liberal Democrats. And to my mind, when people, I live in Europe part of the year, and people over here are still asking, how did Donald Trump get in the first place? Because they read the liberal newspapers, of course, from the U.S. And what it told me is how Donald Trump did get in the first place. There's a whole other world out there that it's easy to lose sight of in the Midwest, in churches, in gun groups, in all of the places he mentioned. And we, you know, we're happy and insulated because we're all alike, perhaps, you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe one of you's voted for Donald Trump, but, and so I don't think he was really, I didn't get any impression that he wouldn't be, that he would be happy if Trump, I think he was alerting us to the fact that it's wonderful to have these discussions, but are we walking our talk? Are we, you know, I have read so much just this week about people who say they're not religious, that they're spiritual. I've said that myself. I mean, I'm a, quote, fallen away Catholic. But I don't have a community at my church because I don't go to church. And I think that's the point. But that's what I got from it, that it really, how do we explain to other cultures how he got in the first place and that he may very well get in again?
And we might have to admit that we have not been creating community and we've not been active and we've not been taking care of some things at that more local level, and that we have some of our own work to do. I don't know. Who else wants to add to the conversation?
Barb.
Mary Rose?
Thank you, Barbara. Barbara's my friend who lives in Switzerland, who just spoke. But I think he was not chastising us, but just pointing out in a very concrete way that even though we know words matter, signs on your lawn, all they are is a sign on your lawn. They don't mean that you go and take active parts in trying to work on the Black Lives Matter movement. I know Linda and some of us wrote postcards for candidates that, as a grandmother's group, for candidates we thought would be great in the Senate, and many of us probably gave money, but I ask myself this question all the time, just in light of everything that's going on in our world, not just the election. How much is enough? I mean, how do you give of your time and talents, you know, and not get sick? it's a challenge, absolutely. But I think his talk was very, it made me a little ashamed. That's what I'll say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talk about being thoughtful, original, and provocative. It was that, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Barb.
You know, and then Paula. So, you know, we have talked about, one of the former speakers was talking about this group that gets opposite sides talking. And that is a long process. You know, Tim talked about the fact that that takes a whole lot of time. But I'm thinking that that is a way that we might be able to participate. And because I don't think this is ever going to come together. And at the break, I went up and I listened to Tim and Marjorie's program. And Chuck Todd was on. And he suggested something that nobody on the program thought about. That if Trump loses, he may run again. In which case, because of that group that is out there that is supporting him, we need to talk to the other side. Mary Rose, keep it together. and maybe that's a role we can play.
Mm-hmm. Paula, well, you were next.
Also, if he loses, we're probably not going to, from everything that's happened with the Supreme Court, we're not going to have the election results validated for a long time, because it's very clear to me that he is going to go all the way to the Supreme Court. He has no problem doing it for anything else. It is going to be, my husband says, even if there were a vaccine, he thinks there'll be huge riots and horrible things in the U.S. Just back to,
let's just take a deep breath.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Take a deep breath and get grounded. And we're in Thursday before election, right. And we don't know anything about the future. So just take a deep breath. And Paula, it's your turn.
Paula,
you're muted.
Thanks a lot. What I liked about him is he said, I'm giving you the bad news first. And it was like about 10, 15 minutes. And, but when he defined political, you know, he defined the hobbyism of just kind of listening. And then he defined political engagement of working with other people that are working with a strategy or an organization to influence the government. Okay. So, is voting, that's voting, correct? Or that's doing the postcards, or that's working with a group to get out the vote, correct? that's political engagement, right? Because I think that we'll have a lot more of that in this election. And I understood what he said about, you know, we've become very national. And I see it in myself very national, partly because, you know, I feel like it's easier to keep track of Trump's abuses than it is to ignore them. I don't think that's good. But, you know, there's been in Cambridge, there's been quite a bit of working with other people, working on a strategy to influence. Like there was a whole group here right after Trump was elected about flipping the House. And there were like a lot of people who showed up at that first meeting to flip the House. And then, so what I'm saying is, I think that, I think we have a lot of engagement right now. And I think it's, it makes me more hopeful or more interested in continuing that engagement. So that's all I have to say. But I thought it was illuminating the way he talked about the hobbyism, then he defined the political engagement, and it was very interesting, his point of view. I'm going to definitely read his book.
Thank you, Paula.
That's all I have, yeah.
Mary Margaret, and then Mary Ann, and then Barb, you've already spoken, so.
I was thinking that I was one of those people that wrote postcards, and I felt like I was, you know, I was really doing something good, and I was very aware that I could choose when I did it. I did it at home by myself. Yes, I was working with grandmothers and, you know, people around, but it didn't push me to get out of, you know, to give up my birding and go and sit with other people in my local community and figure out some of the issues right here. And I mean, what he talked about made me realize that, yeah, you know, it's easy to give money or to sit and write postcards. Takes much more time and effort and energy to get out in the community and, you know, get to know more of the local leaders or even the state, or, you know, go into the state and knock on doors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mary Ann.
I had a similar reaction to Mary Margaret. I was thinking what Paula said, because when I first heard him say there's less activism now than there was before, I was surprised, because everybody I know is doing something.
Yeah.
But the something they're doing is writing postcards and giving contributions, which is what I'm doing. But, you know, in the last election, I was canvassing and knocking on doors, and,
yeah,
you know, I just didn't feel motivated to do that this time for whatever reason. So yeah, maybe he's right. And the other thing I thought of is what he was saying about Massachusetts and the fact that we're all in support of our senators being very liberal and supportive of broad climate change, for example, issues on the national level, but not doing it so much here. And even more locally, there was a housing bill in play in Cambridge last year. And, you know, at the time I told myself that, well, you know, this wasn't the right bill, but now I think that was the wrong thing. And if I had thought about some of the things he's saying, I would have had a different view. At some point, you just have to do it.
Interesting.
Thanks, Marianne. Yeah, I'm feeling, okay, Beth, go ahead. You're muted.
Yeah. Hi, thanks. Gosh, I'm losing my train of thought. I was incredibly moved by his talk. To me, it was such a paradigm shift. You know, like, we can talk about what we're doing, but it still is this focus on, and not that national politics doesn't matter. Like, you know, of course we want Trump out, right? And of course his policies do affect us. But I was so moved by the story of Nah, and I'm so excited to read the book and see what else he has to say. And, You know, and just like imagining this man on a local level talking to his neighbors and people that he could relate to and getting them all to vote. And then knowing that that got recognized on a national level like that, I'm really naive politically. And I was like, really? They noticed that the voting block in Brighton, Massachusetts, like went up, you know, and was like 2/3 higher than other precincts in Massachusetts or something like that. And then the politicians come to them, you know, the politicians come to them and shovel their snow and, yeah, you know, and ask what they want and need. Like that to me is such a shift. It's such a perceptive shift for me of what I don't love the name of his books, his book, you know, Politics for Power. So I had to look at, I looked it up and I looked at the subtitle and it's like, you know, that's real power, but power for good, you know, power to change, for real change. And it's just beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you, Beth. What I wanted to say, a way that I feel challenged, I mean, and I wouldn't trade 1 minute of writing the postcards, because for me, it's been very powerful to know that in my elder woman's voice that I am writing a direct message to other elders in other states and saying, I care about how you vote. To me, that there is something very special about that. That's good with me. But my challenge is that, you know, my son Michael and I have walked in the Mother's Day walk for the last 3 years. Of course, this year it wasn't a walk. It was a fundraiser. But, well, they had a virtual walk, actually. Because I know a woman whose son was murdered, and she's involved, and she, you know, I walked to support her. So we did this walk. It's about 7 or 8 miles on Mother's Day and into the government center. And it's important, and it raises money, and it shows that people care about what's happening. So that's fine. But then after that, she has started a whole program of doing art with traumatized children from the neighborhoods that she's talking about, either who have parents who have been murdered or parents are incarcerated. And I said, okay, I'll be part of that. And there's my challenge, is because the walk is one discrete moment. This project now, I've been on Zoom, I've been in meetings. It involves very concrete things like buying art supplies, getting them to the families so we can be on Zoom doing art projects, and who do we get to do them, and who will help us, and when will it be, and how will you figure out who comes and who most benefits, and then how will you figure out if it does benefit them? And it's a thing, you know, and I think that's what he's talking about, is how do we make room for this thing that actually lives in the streets and lives in the homes and lives in the hearts of people and maybe makes change. And it's a lot. I mean, I just want to name that I've been feeling that challenge the last couple of months as part of this other group. Very different from that one time showing up. Like he said, stage one is standing here, but stage two is something else. We have time for a couple more comments or sharings. Linda?
I just wanted to really thank Susan, because that was really illuminating, your whole pre-talk about you know, the different, I didn't really understand that different way of casting and counting votes. And I, you know, we often say, I think it's ridiculous in this country that there's so much focus on the very few states that are swing states, and it's almost as if the rest of us really don't matter. It's not the candidates don't go there, their issues aren't, you know, articulated or addressed. And so I have always wondered, is there a better, different system? And it's really nice to have been able to contemplate something that's different.
Yes.
So thanks.
Thank you, Susan. There's someone who hasn't spoken yet who wants to share something. I can't, are there hands? I'm not seeing Mary Margaret, because people are on blank screens. All right. Virginia and Marianne, and then Barb Valandry. Just three quick comments. No Barb. Okay. Marianne and Virginia.
So I second the thanks to Susan. I was wondering if you could share that schedule with us.
What do you want to share?
The schedule that you showed with
the screens.
the samples of the various voting types.
I can do that right now.
Sure, thank you.
Right now.
Okay.
Find it again.
And Virginia?
Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay. I don't have the ability to go around and knock on people's doors, but I do have the ability to telephone people and be interested in people's problems and so forth, especially here, as I had said before, my direct neighbors. And I interact with some of them when I see them, but often it's on the phone.
Thank you.
So